So I remember thinking to myself about a year ago, something like that. I'm terrible with time and calendars and numbers, stuff like that. But about a year ago, sometime last year, I was trying to convince myself I really should get around to fixing the drawer in my desk at work, one of my drawers. Like if you were to pull it out just right, half the drawer comes out, half does not, and everything spills out, and it's wonderful. It's like a nice little Halloween prank that I pull on, April 1st prank that I pull on myself every week. And so what I figured out was, you know, all I need to do is just go buy some wood glue. If I just buy some wood glue, it'll help bind that, those pieces together, let it set, let it dry, and I'll go take care of it. So, you know, me being a kind of an action-oriented person, went out and bought the glue. But then, you know, when I'm at work, I kind of get wrapped up in my own thoughts and trying to get things done, and I think about this, A, B, C, and this. And so I have a list of priorities of things I need to get done every day when I'm at work, and that one just kept dropping to the bottom of the priority list. And so I kept neglecting to put it off until one day it occurred to me, you know what, I bought wood glue, this desk drawer stinks, why don't I just fix it? And by the time I got around to it, pulled out the wood glue, the whole thing had become a solid block. You could kill somebody if you threw that bottle of wood glue at them. And I think about how oftentimes that is what complacency looks like in our lives, in that we put off something and thinking to myself, I'll get around to it, I'll get around to it. I know it's important, I should take care of this. But at some point, there's so much time has passed that it solidifies and it turns what should be an easy flowing task into something that is like a dead weight in our lives, a solid block of glue. And I looked up in the Merriam-Webster's dictionary what the word complacency actually means, because I know for some of us, whether we're younger or older, maybe English is not our first language, we hear the pastor say all these words, and a lot of times it doesn't make any sense. So it's definition time. It's when you feel satisfied with how things are, you don't want to try to make things better, and you're also unaware of the danger and the deficiencies of the situation. Now, let me simplify that for you. You start to feel like things are good enough. You settle for good enough because things aren't bad enough, basically. Or a simpler way of putting it is that we settle for too little because it's too hard until it's too late. That is probably the best simple version of complacency that we can talk about today. So I want you to be thinking about, when do I settle for too little because it's too hard until it's too late? And I know right now you're expecting to receive some pastoral guilt. Oh, here we go. We're going to get some talk about complacency, about how we need to read the Bible more, we need to pray more. Yes, you should do those things. But what we really want to talk about as we continue our series is how have you grown complacent in discovering and pursuing after God's promises and his purposes for your life? Because it's very easy to talk about this week after week. We've been in this series called Strong and Courageous and talking about it as pie in the sky promises of God or purposes of God in our life, and for it to slip through our fingers until instead of the free-flowing promises and purposes that we should be experiencing of Jesus, we end up with this dead weight that we don't know what to do with. So if you have a Bible, turn in it to Joshua chapter 18. As I mentioned, we're in the series Strong and Courageous. This is the historical account in Joshua of how God's people live out courageous faith in God's presence for God's purposes according to God's promises. And last week we talked about how the grace, the unearned grace of God's promises and the challenges for God's purposes are intimately intertwined, that courageous faith sees those things, receives those things as God's blessing. And so the Israelites receive the land for the people's good, that's God's promise, but they're also to take the land for God's glory, that's their purpose. And likewise, in the land that Jesus has given us, you and I, in our own heart and life, in the people that we have relationships with, in the places that we have impact, we are to take it for God's glory and for people's good by the power of Christ working in us through his Spirit. And so we challenged you last week to consider, how do you see the lot that God has assigned to you, the land that God has given you in those three areas of you personally, in your relational life, as well as missionally in the places and people that you could impact for God's kingdom? And today, what we're in the midst of this story, to catch you up, we're halfway, at the halfway point of the distribution of the promised land, the inheritances to the various tribes of Israel, which has been fascinating reading, I'm sure, for many of you. And as you remember, 5 of the tribes of Israel have already received their land, including 2.5 tribes east of the Jordan River, not including the tribe of Levi. So if you add all that up, including the 2 half-tribes that were of the sons of Joseph, there's still 7 tribes remaining. I know you think, like, Josh, you just told us your math sucks, but don't worry, I looked this up, all right? So there's 7 tribes remaining that need to receive the land, and there's a very important lesson that we're going to learn from them today. So if you don't catch anything else, the big idea here is that God challenges his people out of spiritual complacency into active participation in his purpose, in his promise for the land. Very simple. All right, so let's pick up here in chapter 18, verse 1. Then the whole congregation of the people of Israel assembled at Shiloh and set up the tent of meeting there. The land lay subdued before them. There remained among the people of Israel 7 tribes whose inheritance had not yet been apportioned. So Joshua said to the people of Israel, "How long will you put off going in to take possession of the land which the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you?" Let's stop right there. What's happening here? Verse 1, the entire nation, the entire congregation of the Israelite people are assembled at this town called Shiloh for big issues that concern all of them as the people of God. So let's make a few observations about what we've read so far before you fall asleep. All right. First of all, the town name Shiloh literally means place of rest. This is significant for us. In their original language, it means they've named it place of rest because the Israelites have shifted operations from Gilgal. If you remember, for those of you who've been tracking with us in Joshua, that was their first camp as they crossed the Jordan River, entered the Promised Land. They've shifted operations from Gilgal to this town of Shiloh, from their war camp to a place of rest, from violence to peace. Secondly, they've set up, in verse 1, the tent of meeting. If you don't know what that is also known as the tabernacle. For those of you who were last year with us through the study through Exodus, it is this beautifully constructed tent filled with elements to worship God, where people go to make sacrifices for their sins before God, where the very Ark of the Covenant, the presence of God manifest on earth with his people, is there. And so what's significant about this tent of meeting is this is God dwelling amongst his people. He's pitching his tent alongside them at the center of their community. And so the people met with God through the tent, through the priest, for guidance, for worship, and for cleansing in their lives. And so that means that this town of Shiloh is not just a vacation spot where you go to rest for rest and relaxation. It's not a spa retreat for them. This is going to be their new center of worship, this city, where the presence of God is going to make his permanent home until much, much later when the capital and the temple are built in Jerusalem. This is going to be where God's leader leads the people as well as where they come as a center of worship. And so this means that when all these people are assembled together, they're not just gathering for a social event. This is not human leaders calling for some kind of secular town hall meeting. This is God assembling his people together for his holy direction. Now, why in particular do they decide to name this town Shiloh, a place of rest? Why are the Israelites shifted into the season of peace and rest? It says in verse 1, because the land lay subdued before them. And I want you to note this. It doesn't say that the Israelites subdued the land. No, it says that it lay subdued for them, that someone else subdued it for them. So even with the remaining Canaanite pagans and idol worshippers in the land, God has given over control of the land to the Israelites so that it is in a state of peace. It is a place of rest. Verse 2, God tells us what the purpose of him gathering his people is. He's going to finish the distribution of the inheritance to the final 7 tribes who haven't received it yet. Come to this place of rest, but not for a church picnic. Because after you Israelites have been wandering for 40 years, you've been swept up in war for the last 5 years, the presence of God is settling down here. And so his people are to also settle down and take possession of the land. This is a holy gathering about their inheritance. Now, in verse 3, because this is a holy moment, it's interesting what God's appointed leader says to the people. He gives them a very strong rebuke, and this is where we want to land in this part of the passage. How long are you going to put off going in and taking possession of the land that the God of your fathers has given to you? And that word in Hebrew, put off, is the key where we want to land in this part of the passage. It means to relax your grip. It means to sink down, to dropped the ball, to slack off. And so Joshua's pronouncement on the people of God, those seven remaining tribes, is that you have grown complacent. Putting off. You have grown complacent. Well, why does he say that? Because unlike way back in chapter 14, verse 6, when the people of Judah, it says, came to Joshua at Gilgal to request for and receive their inheritance, these final seven tribes, they didn't bother. They don't come to ask for anything. They don't come to receive anything. God instructed all of the Israelites to take the land, and they have it. Instead of spreading out, they've huddled together. They're waiting around. They've been hanging out at Gilgal ever since the war has been over. And so you can imagine the thinking in their mind. We fought so long. We fought so hard. The battle is won. Now we're in a time of peace. We're in a place of rest. Now Judah and Ephraim and Manasseh, you know, they can do whatever they want, but the rest of us, we just want to hang out and chill out a little bit, all right? So why don't you take a chill pill, Josh? Calm down. Sit down. But in so doing, what they're doing is ignoring and refusing the very instruction, the will of God in the land for them. Do you ever do that with God? Where you know that God has called you to do something, to take care of an area of your life, or to be present, the presence of Jesus in a place. And what we do with God is, you know what, how about tomorrow? What's the rush? Can't we, you know, I'll get to it later. I wish I could just press the snooze button with Jesus for a little bit. It's such a nice day outside. Maybe tomorrow. Maybe next week. Maybe never o'clock. Okay. And so, you know, a lot of times we come to God and we fall into a state of complacency because we're so busy during the battle times that when we come to a place of rest, sometimes we want to slow down, but we also want to check out. And so the first step in recognizing when we have put off God's purposes and promises and how we have got there is to look at when the excitement of the battle is over. There's this tendency for us to get lulled into complacency by peace, by rest in our daily lives. When actually God is using that exact season of peace and rest to prepare you, to prompt the Israelites and us to go take the land that he's given. You know what I'm talking about? After you've experienced some kind of intense battle in your life, and once that adrenaline rush has passed, we often have a sense of, I just don't feel like doing it anymore. Whatever that thing is that we're supposed to do next, I don't feel like doing anything, in fact. And then we miss out on what God actually wants us to take and receive. Is it wrong for us to rest? Is it wrong for you to rent a car, rent a cabin, and take a vacation? No, of course not. God commands us to rest. Is it wrong to say, though, you know what? This cabin is so great. Forget about my family. Forget about my job. Forget about my purpose. Let's just move there. Yes, because that is the human heart's tendency when we get lulled into complacency in seasons of rest. Let me illustrate for you this way. This past week, I was talking to a young single mom, not from our church, and she was telling me about the father of her son. The father of her son was very excited about having a son, about the idea of a child, and did a great job of taking care of her during her pregnancy. And so he would do things like make sure that he was thoughtful with providing her food or providing her flowers. He was very present and supportive in the delivery room itself, which a lot of dads are not always great at. But once the baby came, once those battles were over, something changed, something turned in that young man. Ah, now I can rest. The job is done. The battle is over. My son has arrived. And he started looking at that season of peace as a time of rest from being a husband or for being a dad. And so he spent all of his free time catching up on video games, catching up on TV, catching up with friends, and became more and more of an absent husband and an absent father. And it's funny, and we look at that, and that's a tragedy. But it's interesting how often we also fall into a similar mindset, because the whole purpose of him being in the battle of that delivery room was so that he can be a dad when this kid arrives. How often for us, that's the way we treat God's purposes and promises for our lives. We fought some wars for Jesus' glory in the past. Now I've earned some peace. I want to take a break, even from Jesus, when that place of rest was actually meant to prepare you for the greater glory of taking the land that God has given ahead of you, not resting on the glory of yesterday's victories, of yesterday's ministries, of yesterday's battles. And so let me start with this challenge for you. What do you need to change in how you see a place of rest in Christ? When Jesus gives you a place of rest, do you move in and make it your semi-permanent home? Or do you recognize in that place of rest that the tent of the presence of Jesus resides there and reminds you that the land of your life belongs to Him? It's to be an act of worship to Him for His glory, for others' good. When you take time off to rest from work and ministry, which you should, you also, along with it, tend to take time off from Jesus and His purposes. Where are you lulled into complacency? Where are you like the Israelites, putting off what God has called you to, prepared you to take? God has subdued the land ahead of you, but He's not for us to kick back and sip some margaritas, not for our vacation or our retirement from His kingdom, not to stay in a holy huddle with just other Christians, but to give us the opportunity to be courageous and to take the land for Him. How do you see the land that God is giving to you? How do you see the peace, the season of peace that God has given to you? Do you see it as your retirement home or a place to prepare you and send you out into His purposes? So how does God actually motivate us out of our complacency, our spiritual complacency? Let's look at verse 4. We'll pick off where we left off. Joshua continues on after kind of challenging them, how long are you to put off taking possession of the land God has given you? Provide 3 men from each tribe, and I will send them out, that they may set out and go up and down the land. They shall write a description of it with a view to their inheritances, and then come to me. They shall divide it into 7 portions. Judah shall continue in his territory on the south, and the house of Joseph shall continue in their territory on the north, and you shall describe the land in 7 divisions and bring the descriptions here to me. And I will cast lots for you here before the Lord. The Levites have no portion among you, for the priesthood of the Lord is their heritage. And Gad and Reuben and the half-tribe of Manasseh have received their inheritance beyond the Jordan eastward, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave them. All right, I know reading through this inheritance stuff is so fascinating, right? I know, your life is transformed. So anyways, in verse 4, Josh is instructing to them, all right, so from each of you remaining tribes, pick 3 cats to come and join this team. I'm going to send them out together as a team to survey the remaining land, and they're to do several things. Write up a report about the land. Write up, you know, what you see about the fields and the harvest and the trees and the fruit and the water sources and the native livestock and the predators and anything about the land that's going to be relevant as your inheritance. And so when you finish that up, this team of guys, you report back to me, and then he goes into further detail in verse 5. Based on these findings, what you're going to do then, you survey out the land, you scout team, and then you're going to divvy it up into 7 portions, 1 per remaining tribe, right? Pretty easy. And then, of course, keep in mind that Judah in the south and Joseph's tribe up in the north, they already have dibs on their territory, so don't scout out their land, don't take their stuff. God has already given it out to them. And then Josh turns his directly and personally to address these scouts in verse 6. Now, in case you didn't hear me the first time, survey the land, write up your report of the land according to these 7 suggested divisions that you're going to come up with, bring it back to me. And then he has an additional statement, then I'm going to cast lots before God to determine who gets which lot of land as their inheritance from God. All right? Now, where we want to land on this portion is in verse 4. The key here is Joshua talks about things with a view to their inheritance. Look at verse 4. Provide 3 men, blah, blah, blah. Send them out. They shall write up a description of it, the land, with a view to their inheritances. This is how God, through Joshua, is trying to inspire these 7 remaining tribes of people. Write up descriptions of the land to give to the remaining tribes to view what's going to be their inheritance. Take a snapshot. Bring it back. Post it on Facebook. Post it on Instagram so all the complacent people can see what they're missing out on, what they've been sitting on in this place of rest, what I, God, am offering them, what they, as Israelites, should be anticipating. Let their mouth water over the fruit and the beast that's in the land. Let their hearts dream about settling these fields of grain or that view from the mountainside. Let them think and see that God has been true to His promises of a land flowing with milk and honey, that they might become eager for the great blessings that I, God, am offering. And the lesson we learn from here, when we talk about people who are stuck in a complacency, a place of complacency and rest, is that God encourages His people to action with a view of the land as their inheritance. That He wants them to get a tangible snapshot, a picture, paint a picture in their minds of what God is offering to them, and it moves them to take it. You see, when we don't feel motivated to engage God's purposes and promises in our lives and in our land, perhaps what we need to do is to also step out, step back, get up close like the scout team to gain an inheritance view of the land, to see for ourselves what is this inheritance, what is this gracious gift God has given to me, to reflect on that so that we can receive it and take it as a gift of grace. I spent a lot of my pastoral ministry time meeting with people, and I have the great privilege oftentimes to meet with couples. Sometimes I get to see couples at the beginning, before they get married, doing their premarital counseling. Unfortunately, sometimes I also meet with couples near the end of their marriage, when they've come to me as a last resort. And a lot of times when couples are at that place, they're struggling. Nobody ever gets married saying like, man, I cannot wait till the day I get divorced. At least I hope you don't think that way as you enter into that kind of relationship. Everybody has great hopes, great dreams. But as the years pass, as we grow comfortable, sometimes grow a little bit complacent in how we relate to one another, the struggles of that differences in personality, our differences in dreams between spouses, our differences in expectations start to become more and more magnified. It's easier to live more and more separate lives, separate hearts, instead of being one flesh, as God has called us to be in marriage. And we start to see what God has given us in that other person as if that person is a deficiency, as if what God has given us is too hard, as if that land is not good. Lord, the land of my family is too rocky. There's too much rock in the ground. There's too many trees and forests that I have to constantly clear. There's too many enemies in the land. We look at sometimes our marriages and relationships as if they were the land of Canaan. And so I'll challenge people sometimes, what if God has specifically given you that person because they're different from you, because the challenge is there for you? What if it's actually good for you? What if it's good for each other because God is using you to refine each other, to bless each other, to teach both of you to grow dependent on Him and to walk in faith with Him and to be a blessing instead of just to see how can my needs be met? How can I be a blesser to that person? And so I'll challenge couples sometimes who are at that last step. I want you to pray. I want you to pray and ask Jesus to open your eyes to see how God has given you a gift of grace. That this person is not a curse, but a blessing, an inheritance that God has given to you. I wish I could say that every time couples get it together and turn it around by the grace of God. But not everyone does. But I'll tell you the difference between these two. What makes a couple successfully able to experience the redemption story written into their marriages and in their families is when they start to be able to say, I welcome my spouse, though they are so different than me, as Jesus' purpose, as Jesus' gift, a gift from God in my life. And they start to survey the land of that relationship, not as, wow, this person is so different, there's such a curse in my life. And instead start to see, wow, Jesus, thank you that you knew all my blind spots. And so you had to bring someone alongside me who's very different. Thank you. You bring someone into my life who challenges me and forces me to grow in different areas and teaches me to be a grown-up rather than expecting things to always go my way and expecting life to always be about me, that I have to learn to be a giver instead of just a taker.